This is a Pinball News production.
How's everybody doing? We're at a pinball show. We're not at a funeral, for goodness sakes. Jeez. I'm really happy to be here. Martin was going to introduce me, but he then said what?
You need no introduction.
All right. Notorious. Thank you. I'm here with Butch Peel, and he has some family members with him, too. It's really a pleasure for us to be here with all of you and everybody that's inside. I know every year Dan and Holly and the whole team do a really great job with this show, and we look forward to it. Last year, I wasn't able to make it. I guess I'm going to go up here, whatever. Butch.
He just wants to be taller than me.
Right. So last year, I got up. I looked at the weather, and there was a snowstorm coming in here. So I chickened out, being, you know, a New Jersey native. We do get snow. Well, actually, I'm a New York native, but living in New Jersey now, we do get snow. So I figured I'm not going to make the show. So Butch carried on in my place and always does a great job. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about The Hobbit. We'll talk about all things Jersey Jack Pinball. We'll take some questions. And we'll be out of here in about 3 or 4 hours. Right? So if anybody has any questions or anything like that, hang on to them. We'll have a couple of points, and I'll turn this over to Butch now, and we'll start our presentation. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Good.
Bernice is here. Everybody's here. My friend Mark is here from Pinball, Arizona Pinball President. Yeah. Eric's here. Hey, Eric, how are you? Best service guy in all of... best service guy around. Really great guy. Really great guy.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Hang on. Here you go, Butch.
Think you have a backup? There you go. This is going to be kind of interesting. It does cut in and out. Kind of interesting holding two hands here.
Maybe you should just talk and forget the microphone.
Just forget it.
Yeah, if you need it.
All right.
It's not working.
Yeah, that'll be a lot easier for me. My mind doesn't. If I chew a gum, I'd be completely overwhelmed with it. So, my name is Butch Peel. I've been working for Jack for about 3 years now, going on 3 years, getting close to 3 years, something like that. I love pinball, love everything about it. That's why I start every one of these talks, and I can't say enough about, you know, the passion I have for the game. I told Jack that in emails and all, that my passion is unmatched. I love everything about it. I sat and talked to the guy in front of Rob Anthony's booth over there for 45 minutes about clear coating and touching up play fields. Just you can't do these sorts of things without learning stuff and tricks and trade of the trade. And I love to share that with people. Love to discuss pinball. Love to play pinball. Love the camaraderie. Love to meet all you people. It's great to come to these shows. And let's face it, pinball is cool. I mean, you go to I'll sit down on an airplane next to somebody and they strike up their little conversation. You know, where are you headed? And going home, or no, I'm going to a pinball show, and it always, the head just whips around, big smile, that is so cool, and I'm like, yeah, isn't it? Yeah, I have a great job, and you know, I work for the Army, that's my real job, been 30 years in civil service. When I walk up and down the halls, I can't get past anybody's office, so, hey, Butch, how's the pinball going? No one ever asked me at the pinball place how the Army thing's going, so pinball must be the cool thing, and you know, air travel and all this fun stuff that we get to do. I was thinking of that the other day, and I saw the scariest sign I've ever seen on a flight one time. Opening the door, going to the bathroom, and I'm sitting there looking at this sign, and you read it, and it says, "Do not flush while seated." And I thought about that for a second, and then I thought, "Oh my God!" You know, so, and you know, you get to where you could do all the things pre-flight. You know, in the event of a in the unlikely event of a water landing, there's no such thing as a water landing on a plane, just so you know. It's a crash if you hit the water. It's not a plane. Yeah, breathe normally if the air, you know, oxygen to breathe normally. Yeah, I'm going to be doing that if we lose cabin pressure. That's going to be fun. So, I get to, as part of my job, I wrote the Wizard of Oz manual. I'm working on the Hobbit manual right now. And my job has kind of morphed to from the original vision that Jack had for me when he hired me, from doing tech support to getting involved with engineering, and I review drawings and I draw schematics, and I'm an electrical engineer by trade, but you know, anything pinball, I'm down. You know, tell me about it and I'm there. I'll help with whatever I can, because I can't get enough of it. I put together one of these a year, and we kind of tour with them, and they kind of morph a little bit. I add a few things, try and make it if somebody saw one of them online or listened in, that they get a little bit of different information. And it's just naturally the way I do a presentation. I never do it the same way twice. So this is an unexpected journey. It's kind of an unexpected journey, because as we go through all this, we got to a point where we thought we were getting close to finished, you know. The game that we took out to Expo last year, we thought that one was going to be The Hobbit. It was done. We took it out there. We got a lot of comments on it, not all positive, and kind of a lukewarm reception. You know, when you ask people what they thought of the game, whether they thought it played well, all those kinds of things. So we went back to the drawing board a little bit. We backed up and said, you know, we can do better than this. We can do a lot of things differently. And we just took a fresh look at it. We got a new, you know, Pat Lawler had joined the company since we started working. He had some input on colors and things like that. And he started looking at the play field, and you could color this up, you could add this, we could put some of the other cool things we had thought we wanted in the game into the game, just make it a lot better. But, you know, what's the trade-off then? Well, then all these people that have pre-ordered are going to have to wait longer for their games. But, by golly, it's going to be a better game for them waiting for it. So Jack came in and said, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to go back and we're going to make the game better. And we're going to have something that we're really proud of when we finish, when we start taking the shows next year. So it put us back a little bit, but the effort was worth it. So playfield wiring, one of the things we always got a lot of criticism for at the factory production. We have engineering in Chicago and we have production in New Jersey. They're kind of geographically separated, so it's kind of an us and them thing. We're trying to keep those together as much as you can, but they kind of said, well, you guys, Wizard of Oz, the wiring was crazy on that. You need to do something a lot better than that. You need to make it easier for us to produce. And so we start thinking, well, we can do that. You know, when we do The Hobbit, we're going to make a completely different lighting system. So we'll make all the cables the same. So you make one cable, and it runs to every single light in the game, you know. So you got 50 cables in The Wizard of Oz, we'll have one cable for your lights in this. It'll be great. Well, when you do that, you end up with a ton of extra wire, because one that runs from this board over to here and one that runs from this board over to here, they're not the same length. So you end up bundling a bunch of it up and you end up with this epic failure right here. So there's comparison. That's us making it easier for them to produce. So you basically get another word from production saying, you know, don't help us so much, guys. We appreciate it. So back to the drawing board again, and now we'll start making some of these wires. Our main control boards are here and here, so we're going to start making cables, groups of cables, and things that are specific assemblies, and you're going to have, you know, 10, 12, 15 different types of cables that'll run, but we can then make it a lot smoother. So this is what it looked like before, and this after working on it a little bit, trying to reduce things. You see a much narrower trunk of wires. Incidentally, as I look at this picture right here, I keep getting feedback. I stand next to the game and I make fun of people and, you know, joke with them along as they play, try and help them along, try and distract them so their ball time's not so long and somebody behind them gets a chance to play, you know, those sort of things. One comment I've gotten over and over again is how wide open the play field is on Hobbit, and they love it. Well, this is what a wide open play field looks like underneath. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there, and you get things that poke up out of the play field. You get individually resettable drop targets. It's just going to be a ton of wiring. It's going to be a ton of logic and all controlling that. When you get down into the cabinet, you're going to have a lot of drivers working all those coils and everything. But, you know, the whole game, it's just amazing what we can do with that. And it feels open on the top side. And if you lift that play field, you know, there's a lot of stuff in this game. Very heavy. So how do you start a pinball machine? You start by lining up your play field. And you get designer people go into a drawing package like AutoCAD, and they start drawing what they, you know, a layout for the game. And there's certain things, you see little lines on the flippers and all, there's sweet spots to the flipper. So you line up shots with those different sweet spots, and you say, well, this has a fan, this flipper has a fan of like that, so I can shoot things over here, and this flipper could hit, you know, these sorts of things, and this flipper should be able to make that ramp. You start lining up and predefining, you know, where your shots and your capable capabilities lie in the game. You're going to start putting in things like slingshots. You know, it's going to introduce side-to-side motion, so that helps hitting these drop targets that are difficult to hit with the flippers on the very ends. It all starts coming together in a drawing like this with no playing capability. You're just using your experience on how you know a flipper works and its range and the things that it can hit. So then this is Joe Balser's original drawing for The Hobbit. He worked on this quite a bit in his own little area without anybody looking over his shoulder, leaving him alone, let him do his thing while we finished up The Wizard of Oz. As he's working on this, no one bugging him, no one asking him about it. Everybody's kind of like, he's working on it, let him go. Well, I came up in I guess it was May of 13, and yeah, heck, I'm a pinball fan. I'm like, what do you got, Joe? Let me see. Show me. He sits down at his computer, and he starts showing me on the, and everybody's like, geez, how'd you get it? Well, I asked. That's how I got to see it. So he made me a print out of this and signed it, put, you know, in a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. Something I'll treasure. You know, it's one of these things that's really cool to have. I've got this entire layout while Jersey Jack Incorporated is showing this little corner down here and this little outlane over here. And I'm like, they trusted me to keep it, and I kept it. You know, I rolled it all up and stuck it under a pinball machine in my shop. No one even knew it was there. But I rolled it out for this just to show how with the original concept. You don't know things like Smaug, what you're going to do there. You put in extra flippers, things as much as you can, because you know some of this stuff's going to change. You don't know what's going to get cut a little later on, what's going to work, what's not going to work when you actually get to flipping it. But something like Smaug up here, we didn't know exactly what we were going to do there, but we wanted him to interact with the ball originally. And so the ramp was going to come around here, and this thing was going to completely encircle him and come down, and he might come out and the magnet grab the ball, or he might just knock the ball off the ramp as it goes around him. We might do away with this ramp later and try and hit him with the ball. There's a bunch of different things, but all that goes in with licensing and the small character, you know, Warner Brothers, when you tell them we're going to bash him with a pinball, they're like, don't really like that idea. So, you know, move around. Well, we're going to have him eat the ball. Well, you know, yeah, I don't think Smaug would eat a ball. Okay, well, then we'll do maybe we'll do something else. Well, he likes to talk, right? So that's what it kind of works into, is you get a talking creature up in the corner up there that taunts you and blows fire across the play field and tells you how powerful and awesome he is and what little chance you have of keeping that multi-ball going. So we start out with four flippers. There used to be a flipper up here also. It turned out that, you know, online people start seeing some of these drawings and they say, what are you shooting with those upper flippers? Well, we kind of think about that and we say, you know, there's some interesting stuff to do here, but there's really only one hole there, and the geometry didn't work out. A bunch of rattle when we started making these steel ramps. So this flipper became something that we could get rid of. And so we put a slingshot in there, and it actually is kind of cool because the ball bounces up there. It bounces right across and feeds this upper flipper to do something else. So we can shoot at the drop targets here and shoot in the hole there. Actually, as we continue to work on this and make these edges of the ramp more round, we could actually start making this shot with that upper flipper when you hit it just right. And those are the satisfying shots that keep guys coming back playing over and over again. Oh, let's see, he originally had a pop-up between the pop bumpers, like the old space shuttle, the heat shield, you know, that pops up out of the play field to keep the ball from draining down here. That was one of the original concepts too. It was kind of funny when we had the whitewood set up. He didn't have it attached at the bottom. When it popped up, it literally popped up right up in the air and it landed in the play field. One of those fun things that goes on with the whitewood. So the steel ramps, the subway, a lot of the features, you know, the snaking through the pop bumpers, the pop bumper locations, a lot of that, flippers and all made it to the final. And these were the little axes that kicked with the slots, or with the slings, stayed in all the way to the end, the laser kick. All those sorts of things that we put in, all four trolls. When I saw the four pop-up assemblies, I thought, sure, some of those are going to get cut. And I said, I hope they don't, because I really love the things that pop up out of the play field. But he originally decided we're going to have something kind of like the witch target in The Wizard of Oz up here. So he actually drew the witch target in there, that rubber pad that can be hit. So that ended up getting changed, as we'll see in a few minutes. So now when you have the drawings, the next step is you've got all those drawings tell exact locations of all the holes and everything. You have a whitewood made up, and you drill, have somebody CNC route and make all the holes. And And the primary ingredients of the game, the pop-ups, the rollovers, the drop targets, the targets behind them, you can start putting those in. And then you can start deciding where to put things like inserts and lights and all the bells and whistles that make the game so great. First, crack here, we didn't even have a Smaug in there. We just knew that was going to come later. You know you're going to put some stuff on the pop bumpers. You're not going to spend money at that point or try to get barrels made that are on the end game. So, you use what you have in hand there to show clearance and that sort of thing. So they just happen to have some Wizard of Oz trees handy for some reason. So they put them on there and started shooting it with that. And these are some of the first videos that Jack released of Keith shooting the game, which, of course, is like, none of the rest of us can shoot like that, but it's kind of cool to watch. It's much better for a video, when the guy can actually make the ramp when he shoots and not clunk, clunk, clunk three times. And I'll get it this time. Take 12. Let's get it. I'll make it. I know I will. So now they can take this and they can superimpose on top of that whitewood. They can start putting artwork. So in the same time that the guy's drawing all the assemblies and everything, the artist starts taking into account where we might put some inserts, and he starts working in his boundaries, which is this die line that goes all the way around. You notice there's no artwork inside of here. And that's kind of old school artwork for pinball, in that under slings, and you look at some of the electromechanicals out there, they only painted where they needed to, and then they left, the area that the ball was going to roll in was painted. And then areas in underneath slings and under plastics and things like that, they left the wood grain, and it has a certain artistic quality to it. It's very pretty when you do that. So that's the way we build our play fields at Jersey Jack. So we make sure that we leave a little wood showing through, and it's just kind of an homage to the old designers of old, and it really makes for a pretty, when you take that as a play field and hang it on your wall, it makes for a neat piece of art. So this is J.P. DeWin's first cut at the playfield artwork. We had a gentleman working on it before that had started it. He moved on to some other task while we were trying to decide whether to do this or that. And people find other work. So J.P. took over the job here and started adding in playfield elements, artwork elements. And when you have a license like The Hobbit, when you got a guy like Peter Jackson doing movies, you have a wealth of information, a wealth of assets that we license as one big package, because you virtually put anything from the movies or the posters or anything like that onto there, and they just do fantastic artwork. So had a lot of things to draw from, but when you got an open area like this, you're like, what can I put in where? But you know that you have to stay within these lines. You have to fill up these lines. That's JP's ground rules there. That's the rule of thumb, is you got to fill your boundaries. So as these boundaries change, when you start doing things with layout that affect those boundaries, obviously that's going to have a ripple effect through JP's work, and he's going to have to redo areas. So when we start making holes smaller and moving things around, he's going to have to read and react to that and be able to put something else out. So this is the first cut. You see a lot, he comes in, first thing is you, in a drawing package, you can take things that look like inserts and start putting them in. So he hadn't even got them all in on this first cut when he started sending it out to people. And he's just asking us, what do you think about this? And guys like myself get to come back and say, I think that looks really good. I'd add this or add that. Now he, through the magic of digital work, he can take that now and superimpose it on top of that whitewood that we had earlier on that photo. He can change his perspective and tilt things and drop it right down on top of there. And then he can also start putting in the plastics and try and get an idea what the shape of the plastic's going to be. Maybe even start adding some artwork to the top of those plastics and try to decide early on. We thought, well, we're going to have a man side of the playfield, we have elf side of the playfield, and we have the dwarfs up in this area. Originally, we thought maybe we'd do something with Lake Town up in this area, and then Smaug was going to have a big mountain all around him in here. So just, start leaving these areas that we know are going to need a lot of work for later. And we were thinking of putting the little book LCD thing was originally slated to go in this area right here. Now it's up in this area of the game. But you got to start getting a three-dimensional look to it. Well, then you can continue working in two-dimension also. So this is version 4 already. And he's starting to add things here, like the inserts, the around these hurry-ups that light the pop-ups, they're going to, the borders around here, just little intricate little details, borders around here match the border of the one that it's going to bring up. You start with the big mountain in the center, you know, Erebor, that's a focal point of the movie. And of course, Smaug being in there also is a really cool thing. Now, when you start early on, like in a movie like we did, that they're so protective of their assets that are coming yet, that let us see them, to let us know what we can use in the future, but do not let any of that leak before that. In this day and age, you know, anything on the internet gets out. Well, they take and watermark everything, so every person has their own watermark. If your image gets out, they know exactly who's the guy that leaked it through some, either being negligent or just being, you know, trying to be cool and release something to somebody. You can't keep it to yourself anymore, not in these days. So, you know, we had good Smaug images, but we couldn't use any of those early on. So we end up with what Jack calls the flying rat on the playfield. He's not that prominent because we didn't see that much. All we saw in the first movie was his eye. You know, that's basically all you saw. And the second movie's coming out hopefully around the time this game was to be originally released. So, you know, we might be able to do a little more, but you can't wait for that kind of stuff. If you do, then you put everything behind. You know, the artwork's got to be working on at the same time as everything else and bringing it all into one package so you can get all the holes in the right place, you get all the mechanisms mounted, and you can have all your artwork and all of this marry up and tie together. So from version 4 to version 6, you see he starts putting in some of these little details in between. One of my first things, I said, why don't we just break up the artwork around those inserts there, make it where they don't have a circle around them, you know, make it look like the water's splashing on them. And they further that idea into the little book is up there now. When the ball is in the pop bumper, water splashes up through the pages of the book. When Smaug blows flame across, there'll be a flame go across the pages in the book. Just little details like that that make things really cool, make them fun to work on. Start putting more ornate borders around things. You know, all the guys here have a really pretty border around them now. Things start getting more defined as we go along. So you'll see little differences, and that's what artists do. They're always wanting to tweak things. So now we go jump from version 6 all the way to version 11. And 11 has, you know, more detail. Start, especially up in this area, this gray is going to be, you know, that's completely unacceptable. We can't just have gray like that. So we start putting all these things in. My wife was asking me about some of the people that were in the movie, some of the characters, and I told them, well, you know, they're not really on there. So I shot JP an email real quick and said, why don't we put these big guys that were trying to cook them, you know, I forget what they call those beasts, the great big ones, William, I think was one of his names. Anyway, and so he starts adding things like that in these little vignettes in between. He says, you know, the throne room for the elf king and all these kinds of things, you can start just kind of fading those in the background. Not unlike what we did with the Wizard of Oz around the center, where you see all the things that were flying around in the tornado, the old lady on her bicycle that became the witch, things like that. So go from 11 now. You start putting the plastics in place again and start adding the artwork that so make these flow. So all this area down in here that's showing the inside of this throne room and inside Erebor, now that kind of follows across onto your sling artwork. The guys are both swinging axes there, so why don't we put guys on here that have the, you know, that carry those axes? Then the real hobbit nerds start telling us, well, those axes don't look like the ones that were in the movie. That's so-and-so's sword, and it has this name. And like, whoa, man, you guys are way too much into this. But not, though, because there's a lot of our fans that are the same way, and they're buying this because they know we'll be true to that. So a lot of the artwork can be starting to put on to the plastics, and again, you've got borders to work with, and these are going to change if we move things around. Just keep that in mind as we go through this presentation, that every time we make a change, it has a ripple effect through all the guys making drawings, through all the guys doing artwork, through all the guys manufacturing parts, through all the guys trying to keep those parts on the shelf. Everything changes, so it's going to increase the end goal by quite a bit. So licensed assets, just thought I'd throw this in there. People don't kind of understand what it's like to work with somebody like Warner Brothers, and it was great with Wizard of Oz. They let us have everything, you know, we had a couple of times where we tried some stuff and weren't allowed to do it, but for the most part, you know, the movie had been out 75 years, so obviously everything in the public domain, everybody knew what everything was, and the movie, we weren't trying to keep something secret that was still coming in a later Wizard of Oz movie, so it was a little bit different boundaries, but we thought we had a pretty good working relationship with them. Well, people online would complain about, why do you put Balin the dwarf? Why Vili the dwarf? We all know they're dwarfs. Why do you put the dwarf? Well, that's part of the licensed assets. They give us all these images, and if you put that on your play field underneath that dwarf picture, guess what? It's going to get approved a lot quicker than if you try and do something creative. Wizard of Oz, I saw some pre-work that Greg Ferris did that was just beautiful. You know, he did the Scarecrow, and he made the letters look like there were pieces of straw coming out of the letters, and it was really stylized. Well, you send that to Warner Brothers, and what do they say, Jack?
No.
Yeah. They don't want anybody, you know, looking at Scarecrow and thinking that says Scarf Crow or something like that. And, you know, you've got to be able to really see what our characters are and readily recognize their names. So they tell you what font to use. They literally say, you're going to use this type of font or you're not going to put the word Scarecrow on that play field. And if you put the word Scarecrow on there, you can put the little TM next to it and all those other rules that go along with it. You're going to put a licensing thing at the bottom of the play field. So anything we can do with stuff that's provided to us, put that in our play field. That makes the entire approval process go much smoother and much quicker. Anybody that's ever done, incidentally, I was talking about play field touching up earlier, some of the paints and colors that you use are very transparent. If you try and put a yellow color over wood grain, the wood grain shows through underneath it. You want that yellow to be very opaque. You put it over an insert, you want that, when that insert's lit from behind, you don't want that to completely wash out the letters. They need to be opaque so that you can still read them when they're lit. So there's a white layer underneath. This is the version 15 of it. Every time the surface artwork changes, the white layer has to match it also, because what we're doing is we're going to put a layer of white all over the play field and then put the color in on top of this so that the bright whites are going to be super white, the yellows, the reds, everything's going to be super vibrant and stand out. It won't show anything through from behind because this white is extremely opaque. Just a little that you didn't know, that kind of thing. So now we're going to go from version 11 to version 16 here. 16 has just, again, we're adding more detail, smoother transitions from area to area. What do you see? The great big deal, I'll give you a little hint here, the difference between these two versions. The size of the Arkenstone went way down. So our playfield manufacturer, when we told them, yeah, we've got this great idea, we're going to do this big old, like, 4-inch Arkenstone, we're going to put 5 RGB LEDs behind it, we'll be able to twinkle it, do all these different things. Well, he comes back and says, no, you don't want to use a big old 4-inch. That thing won't stay level. It's going to be right between your flippers. You'll have balls hopping all over. You'll have edges starting to work their way up. Oh, all right. So what we did was we put a 1 RGB LED behind it, which, you know, you can still do. You're limited now to 32 million different colors, I know, but it'll be really cool to smaller insert, and it'll be more durable. Thinking again towards the future, it's going to have a ball smash on it, it's going to be in heat, it's going to be in humidity, all these different things. So you need to make sure that's going to survive, and it's part, an integral part of our play field right there in front of the flippers. So you make changes like that. You tell JP now, oh, well, by the way, you don't have a 4-inch insert there anymore, you got a, you know, 1.5-inch. So now all of his artwork has to change, and he has to react to that one little change we made in an insert. You notice the size of the Smaug circle became smaller. You know, we decided on based on what Smaug is more mature now than he was when we designed this layer. So now we've got a smaller hole. We don't need as big a hole through there. Most of him's going to be above the play field. We're just going to need to run some cables through. So now we're not going to run the whole thing through and fasten it from underneath. So those types of things change. And all of JP's borders keep changing as we go. So he's trying to improve what he already has and then reacting to the changes that we make. So here we are getting ready to take this Hobbit game to Expo. We've got Ted Estes over here. He's one of our he's actually an electrical engineer. He does software. He's been working with Williams and all since way back when. Great, great programmer. He and Keith did the software for the game. There's JP DeWin, the guy that's responsible for the magnificent work done on the LCD and our playfield artwork. That was his first playfield that he'd done. He did some work also on the Big Lebowski. Jim Thornton back in the back is one of our managers, and myself, Jack, and then this is Eric Meunier, our lead electrical engineer. He's the guy that did redesign the whole light system for the Hobbit. So now, when we take it out to there and we get our less than favorable responses, guys on pin side, who obviously I have to give kudos, and they know it all already. I'm just trying to keep up with them. Anyway, they come back and we get a bunch of responses, a bunch of criticisms, a bunch of you know, you could have done this better, and lukewarm just in general. So Jack says, well, let's change things up. So Pat Lawler and the rest of our team, we get together, and JP was like, what can you do to brighten up the artwork? This is a pinball machine. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be bright colors. Pat super believes in that. I mean, he's just a color guy. Basic primary colors. I've heard John Yossi talk about working with him, and he's just like, you know, if it's not in one of those 16 Crayola packs, forget about it. That's not, you're not going to go on the play field. So we just look at this, and it's a beautiful play field. I really love the play field. But what can we do to make it brighter? It's a pinball machine. It should be really bright. Well, you can do things like just brightening things, you know, adding more color. Where you've got grays and blues and dark purples, let's put in some yellows and some more bright browns. Even the gold stuff up at the top, you know, can get brighter if you just lighten it up a bit. So that's a huge difference. You know, the characters here, you start making them a little bit bigger. You know, they're smaller there. You make them larger and put a little more detail in them, brighten them up, and get a big change. You know, move down the play field a little bit. You go from the flying rat to this. All the subtle things, like look at the Keely and Feely or Touchy and Feely, whatever those guys are on the outlanes. They go from being parallel to the direction of ball movement to being straight up and down to where you're not turning your head like this to look at their face. It's easier recognizable to the player. All the intricate work around the pop-ups and everything, you can add a little more intricate, add a little color to them, separate them from that background. Move down to the next, and you go from that to that. Again, the mountain is very pretty and all, but now we're going to take those dark grays and purples, and we're going to turn them to green at the bottom. And you can make a huge difference. It's just striking the difference between even the outlines for these pop-ups. Put a little bit of border on them, brighten the colors, and it makes a huge difference. So now you can take that and you can say, well, this is what I propose it's going to look like, and I changed my plastics and everything, and you can directly compare it side by side, and a guy like Jack can look at that for like 30 milliseconds and say, yeah, I think I'll take this one over here. Plastics, same thing. Everything that he did on artwork on the plastics, going to brighten them up. So you go from that to that. Dark to colors. Look at this particular plastic down here and the changes that go on with it. And guess what the big holes mean now? Instead of having dark around the playfield light-wise, we're going to put in flasher domes. So now we had no flasher domes on Wizard of Oz. There's flashers now. So that changes JP's boundaries. Now he's got to move the characters all around so that we don't have that hole right through the middle of Galadriel's face or Tariel's shoulder disappears or something like that. Make it where it fits. It looks like it was made that way, not like we added the holes and just drilled them wherever they happen to fall and make it work. Decals. While you look down here, and these are super ornate and probably took tons of time to put together, they're hard as heck to read. ELF. Believe me, it says that. Man, dwarf. Let's make those a little easier, you know? Make it where people understand they're qualifying elf modes by hitting those three targets over there. Not look like, you know, Andy Taylor's badge or something from Mayberry RFD. Colors. Brighten up. Change the colors for the spinners. Go from the drab thing of the, you know, Bilbo running to this compass look and a dragon up in here. Colors everywhere, more colors. We scale down the size. Again, this is no small thing. It's hardly noticeable, but look how big the decals are for the axes and things. They got much smaller. We decided, let's scale down those metal axes that kick on the slings. That changes everything. All the metal pieces, all the on the decals, everything. LCD evolution. So this is the Wizard of Oz. Everybody, you know, raves over how cool this is, and you know, when you can take over the whole screen and show a particular video, and it keeps showing all of your progress and gives you indicators of things that you need to do. Really cool interface. Well, the last thing we want to do is make one that looks like that, because this is our second game now. Jax told us that Wizard of Oz is going to be the worst game we've ever made. So you start out with maybe a round in the center, square around the edges. No, maybe square in the center, round around the edges. You want to do all these different things. There are going to be a lot of modes in this game. We know that much. Well, you finally get to a point where you know you want to show all the 14 dwarfs, I guess there were, in there. So you need to put those in somewhere. You need to be able to display a lot of information in a little bit of space. And maybe this time we won't take over the whole screen for videos. We'll only use this main area in the center. So from that, you can then go in and start actually dropping in pictures on top of that and kind of get an idea for what it's going to look like. And then after you work on it a little bit more, you can add more ornate borders to it and make it look more like it fits with the theme. And you can start adding more and more detail, make it a little darker here, start showing some of the modes inside. And then Keith says, well, wait a minute, there's not just 14 modes in my game, there's 34. Okay, so then we'll make these smaller, and there's a heck of a lot more of them now. Is this the one? It's one of these is a video. This is it. And then you can start putting your assets inside of there. And we're able to do this a lot quicker the second game because Keith isn't working on an operating system now. That's all set up from Wizard of Oz. So now we can just start dropping in these videos a lot quicker. And you can, this doesn't have any sound, but just to show you some of the, start getting an idea of what it's going to look like. You have to tell people how to launch a ball. They walk up to the game, they have no idea. They don't realize more than one person can play. We're going to try and teach you all of that in a very visual, easy to follow way. And if you're watching this game, this is the kind of stuff you're going to see. Not somebody ball just rolling around the playfield and lights flashing at you. You're going to see what they're doing, what mode they're in, what their goals are. Oh man, as they hit another target and something else comes up, we're updating all around. Just cool, cool things to bring people to the game, make them want to play. So the Expo game, it even has a, this is some pictures that JP took. If you look at this back glass and compare it to the one out there, it's different. The back glass changed. Put more different artwork in the corners, different things. Big change on the apron. The apron used to look like that. We originally thought maybe we put some LEDs in here and show your way as you're making your trek across towards Erebor. Turned out to be not such a great idea, so we moved on. Expo game here. You look at the back, and you can see why, compared to the one out there now, why it was kind of lukewarm. We had chutes instead of wire ramps here, so they had artwork on them. They were pretty. It was really nice, but you know, it made a clunking sound. It just didn't feel right. A lot of artwork across the back. Of course, Smog wasn't in here in this picture yet. Laser etching the ramps, putting all this extra decals on the ramps, putting all of the different structures around here, sculptures and things. And you see the lights here in the front. We're trying to light the playfield up. One of the things we have with Wizard of Oz, it's too dark. So we put an LED bar back here, and it was shining down on the playfield. Well, it made a nasty glare in the player's eye when you were standing there playing. So we tried moving it around, moving it to different spots, and it just never worked in any place. So we replaced that in the new game with spotlights that are mounted strategically around the playfield. What else we got here? And of course the LCD isn't even on this. We had a book sculpture on here that people didn't like. Hot bumpers changed. So we put the LCD back in up here and kept with the tradition of the Wizard of Oz of having more than one LCD in our game. So we've got the mode book that's up here now. And then we decided, you know, there's only one way. There's a magnet up here. If you shot the orbit, the magnet could grab the ball and drop it into the pop bumpers. That was the only way it was ever going to get into the pop bumpers. You start thinking, well, that's not very good use of pop bumpers. So we opened up this area here. We took and moved some of these around and made a way to shoot up into the pop bumpers and added the opto switch there to do that. All these things just making huge differences. No flashers in the long side here. So a lot of different changes we made. And there's not a lot of companies that would do that just based off of input from guys looking at one or two games. Imagine a car company or something like that sending a car out and people saying, well, I'd rather have the steering wheel over here, and this seems too high to me, those numbers can't read them, and they just go back to the drawing board and say, well, okay, well, we'll release this car next year and we'll do that, we'll take that extra expense and time and effort to do that. The prototype out there, we've added lighting underneath. Yeah, I can see these guys when they pop up. Got your flasher domes, it can add a lot more light to the game. You got the Smaug guy that never really completely turns around, turns his back to you. You can watch and turn and talk to you all through the game. The laser etched ramps, all the different sculptures I was talking about, and the gold pile with more flashers in it. Just a lot of details. There's your book LCD. There's completely new artwork for the apron. Ring button now in there so we can do things. And the ring button was going to come into the game at Expo also. It just hadn't got a lockdown bar built for that just yet. Again, these things just look really cool when they're lit from underneath. Go back to the traditional, what people are used to seeing. Sometimes you make a change and you think you're doing something that's innovative and it just doesn't feel right on the game, doesn't look right. You know, that's kind of what those shoots turned out to be. It just didn't look right on the game. People like to watch where the ball's going, and when a silver ball flashes up in there, you saw it go under the play field. Where'd it go? Well, you get a split second of a visual on that that you weren't getting on with those shoots. It just was popping out on the ramp there, and it's like, I have time to do something. I didn't know where it was. Latest prototype with software out there. We've got a way to hook into social networking. You can actually tweet your game. You don't see a lot of that going on out there because there's 14 other people waiting in line to play behind you. As soon as your game's over, you walk away. But this comes up a couple of seconds after the game ends. You can go in with a QR code reader, take a little snapshot of your score. If you were player 4, you'd take this one down here, and it comes up with a pre-made tweet with your, you know, ready to hook into your Twitter account, and says, I just scored this much on the game over in the Denver show on The Hobbit, and you're ready to edit it a little bit, change your score a little bit, add it, whatever. Go ahead and tweet it. And now I guess we can take a few questions. Anybody? Jack will answer too.
Jack, obviously a licensed title brings a lot of benefits, but you seem to have had a lot of issues with licensing this time and what you originally wanted to do. Can you talk from your perspective about the pros and cons of licensing?
So a license like this, where you're getting 3 movies, it was really 2 movies when we first licensed it. Then it became 3 movies. And Peter Jackson's notorious for changing things. So we didn't get a lot of assets up front. Wizard of Oz was 72 years old when we licensed that. So with Wizard of Oz, we knew what the Scarecrow looked like. We knew what all the characters were. We knew what the whole story was, right? With this, we got to go to California. We sat at the Warner Brothers studio in a closed room, and we read the script, and we had things read to us and told to us what would unfold. So we thought we were going to have a Windlands button on that lock bar because there's this tile missing from Smaug, and this Windlands is going to get fired and go through the tile and kill Smaug, right? And Keith and I are sitting at the IMAX theater in December in Chicago, and we're watching the movie, which I thought was the best one of the three myself, and Smaug gets killed, and we both said to each other, expletive! He didn't get killed that way. So that became something different, right? The same thing with what Smaug looked like. You know, my cell phone, I have a case that has a Hobbit case on my phone. It was given to me Christmas time. And it has that image, the same exact image that was on that blue play field that you saw, right? Whoever made this cell phone case was probably upset because he didn't have the asset of what Smaug really looked like. So when we saw that asset, and it was kind of right around the time of Expo, it would be like me saying, we're not putting the Wicked Witch in the game. How can I just say, this game is done, that's it, it's good enough, just get it out of here, and we got to build another game? Everybody that's paying all kinds of money and waiting, well, if you're going to wait a little bit longer, not waiting forever in Wizard of Oz time, because it's different. We're not setting up a factory and all that stuff. we really designed the second game. You saw that all today. You know, and I'm a little exhausted. I have to wake up. I was getting glassy-eyed there with Butch doing that because he's killing me because I don't want to relive that again. It was painful. There were very painful times. Well, a lot of that, but we had to do it because otherwise you'd have a crappy game. And if you want a crappy game, you know, don't buy one of our games. You know, you're going to have to wait for it. It's okay to wait for great things, and that's what we're trying to make. So that's the real long professorial answer to that. So to follow up on that question that you didn't ask me, with Pat Lawler's game, I just came back from the licensing show in Las Vegas, right? And then people running around trying to get all kinds of licenses and everything. I got the greatest license in the world. I have Pat Lawler and a whole team of people. We're making a non-licensed game. I don't need to be at the licensing show this past week. But maybe I'm looking for game number 4 or 5 and 6 and 7. And different licensing companies call us because they want to get in a horse race. So if another pinball company wants to license this thing, they call me up and they say, "Hi, you interested in doing XYZ? I don't know. Well, so-and-so is interested in XYZ. Well, good for so-and-so. Well, you're not interested in that, are you? It's not an auction. It's not a horse race. They can't get a higher property for that." So I go down there and I throw a few bids in just to cause some aggravation.
Spice of life.
I don't care. We get it. We don't get it. We do another Pat Lawler game. So, another question. For Butch? For me?
No, for you.
For me. What's your name?
Don Fendrick.
Don, nice to meet you.
So first of all, thanks for coming out to Colorado. We appreciate
Happy
that.
Happy to be here.
What else can you share about the Pat Lawler game?
I can share that it's by Pat Lawler.
It's a game.
I can share that it's a game. I can share that, you know, his team is there. You have Ted Estes in there. You'll have Keith in there. You'll have John Yowsey doing the artwork. You have John Crutch doing some mechanical things. You have Dave Thiel doing sound. And it's really cool. It's something that we will show this year, later this year. And I don't want to get into the multi-year pre-order things. It was the idea of the company to kind of get off that drug after. And timing is everything, so I think we had good timing with that. So I want to show the game done, pretty much done. And you play the game, and you say, "I like the game, I want the game." And then we're able to tell you pretty much a date when we're really, really going into production, that we're building the game. And the amazing thing, you know, hope by fourth game, you just say, "Hey, we have this game. You know, you want to buy it?" You know, it's getting very boring in my life.
We go into this meeting with Pat to talk about his concept at the very beginning. I can't go into the meeting. I have a secret clearance, work for the U.S. Army. I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement before going into that meeting with Pat just to talk about the concept. I mean, he's very secretive. But the cool thing that he says about it, I can't tell you right now what I'm going to do with it or exactly how it's going to come all together, but I can tell you this. We're going to have fun.
Oh,
that's cool. Yeah. That, those are exact Pat Lawler words right there.
Yes.
I'm Russell.
Hi, Russell.
What else can you tell us about the Pat Lawler game?
Bush, what was that again?
We're going to have fun.
I can tell you this.
Just one thing, Jack.
I can tell you this. It is it's more of a challenge, right? So we've dealt with studios for the last two games. And we want to do something, and they say no. But you have a body of work to guide you in what's going to be in the game. Now, you have a whole ream of paper, and you have to fill up that ream of paper. And the challenge is to make it fun, entertaining, and have value in the game. So really, unlicensed game is a challenge, but I would rather have that actually at this stage. I'm a little burnt out on licenses and stuff like that and the battles that we've had with some of them. So if we want to do something and we want to go left and the group says, "Let's go left," we're going to go left. You know, so that's the other good part about it. And really, Pat is a really wonderful person to work with. He's just, I remember being at a pinball show. Martin, you're the historian in the room. I remember being at a pinball show where Pat kind of predicted the demise of pinball, right? He said, it's kind of going to be gone. And it took a while for Pat to call and say, "You know, I'd like to make pinball if you'd have me," kind of in a really humble, strange way. And remember, you know, I'm a game operator, and years ago I had Pat Lawler games on my route. So if I opened a Funhouse or an Adams Family or something like that, I put that on location and made It made great money. It was amazing. And I never thought I would have a pinball company. It was not a dream. Nightmare sometimes, but not a dream. You know, and it's not really, you know. But imagine me as an operator having this guy in our company design a game with us. I mean, really, you know, it's like Butch said, it's really kind of a dream come true. It's amazing. So it's a lot of fun.
If we have a licensed theme and we tell you we've got The Hobbit, as soon as you heard The Hobbit was going to be the second game, each and every one of you got a picture in your mind. Oh, well, that's going to, I know they'll put that in there. They'll have to have this. This is going to be really
cool. Fire breathing smell.
Yeah, this is going to, if we told you what Pat's game theme was or some of the things, you wouldn't even be able to conjure up an image. It's you need to see it. And you need to see the whole thing all at one time.
If I told you the name of the game,
it wouldn't
help you at all.
It wouldn't help you.
It's like saying Atari. At least that you could get some. It's like the name of Pat's game is called Wallpaper. You know, so like, wow.
Desk and chair or something like that. I mean, yeah, it doesn't make sense.
That's why you really need to see it. And you know, look, other people have said that's the reason they will not do a license, because there's nothing there that somebody could hang a hook on or imagination on to say, oh, I'll order a container of those if you do Star Wars. If I tell you we got the Star Wars license, which we didn't yet, you say, wow, holy cow, I could imagine what that's going to be and all that stuff. Well, it's a little different. So if you think of Pat Lawler Games, when I flipped his game for the first time, what did I play? You know, I played a Pat Lawler game. So it was really cool.
Can you tell, does it tie in any way to any of his past titles?
You know.
Same designer.
I think the fair thing to say is that all designers, whether it's Steve Ritchie, Pat Lawler, John Borg, you know, any of these people, they like to paint with the colors they're familiar with painting with. So they have their trademark bumper placement or their trademark flippers, how they have them, or other features or shots or subways or ramps or things like that. I'm certain that you could recognize things in Pat's game as uniquely Pat, just as you could recognize things in John's game, you know, every one of them have a spinning disc,
sure.
Or, you know, Steve's game, how, you know, the ball is coming right back at you, which are all good. That's why we all have collections. Because one game, you know, doesn't do it for all of us, so we need to have a collection. My wife's falling asleep, so I'm going
to... I'm surprised she's still here.
I know.
I thought she'd left us by now.
Do you have a lot of young people that you see coming into the business, youngers, you know, designers-wise?
So,
how do you see the future, basically?
Well, in our industry, there's just a lot of drama. And you know, it's not only for social media sites where the drama is. Okay, so if you have a designer and a designer worked at Gottlieb, and you have somebody else in your company that worked at Data East, this guy doesn't like this guy competed with that guy went out with the guy's wife when it was his girlfriend, this guy did this, this guy is a Cubs fan, this guy's a White Sox fan, that guy's a... I'm telling you, the level of Martin Shaken, you know, the level of drama and whether it's ego, narcissism, I don't know what. But the good thing is that we are and will be and have hired people that just have a passion for pinball. And they just want to make great games. They don't care really who worked where or who was against who before or why they did this or why they did that. And you know, look, we're all getting older, whether we're 30 or 50 or 60 or 70 or whatever. Everybody's getting older. So if pinball is going to continue, pinball is going to continue no matter what. You need to have new people. Some of them are younger than others. Electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, people that just draw things on napkins. Come in, and we're fostering that, and we're making that happen, because, you know, you can't, there's only one Steve Ritchie, there's only one Pat Lawler, there's only one this guy, one that guy, so if he wants to work for that company, or this guy wants to work for that company, you can't just sit on the sidelines and say, you know, let's wait for that guy to decide to make a pinball machine, you know. We need to be making 2 pinball machines a year. You know, the goal for next year, you write that down. The goal for next year is that we're going to be making 2 pinball machines a year. You know, one every year and a half, or one every 5 years, or one every 9 years. Or That's not good. That's kind of a hobby. That's kind of a hobby thing. Look, it's been a startup. It's been 4.5 years. It's been difficult. Everybody knows my entire life story. You know, it's interesting to have all these crazy threads on social media, and your kids are reading those things. And, you know, like people I go to church with read that stuff. And people that I just meet somewhere, you know, might read that stuff. And, you know, I didn't really sign up for that. I didn't sign up to lose my life. I signed up to make some pinball machines. That's all I wanted to make. I didn't want to have, like, the quasi-wacky Star Trek convention celebrity status of, like, hey, this Jersey Jack. Can we talk to him? Do you think he'll sign for us?
Give him a picture?
You know, it's cool. It's cool, and I get it. And I thank God for all the things that we've been able to do, really. And it's okay. I'm okay with it. You know, it's not kind of okay, you know, the personal attacks and things like that. You know, but remember, I'm Italian, Brooklyn, street operator. So mob guys tapped me on the shoulder and asked me why my games are in there, and I went like that to those guys. I really am not going to be fazed by a couple of people behind a keyboard on Pinside or RGP or wherever. How's your pinball machine company doing today, you know? So it's hard. A lot of people have said building pinball is hard. Come on in, the water's cold, and all those other metaphoric crazy things. Guess what? It gets easier. Building games in our company will never be easy. You know why? Because every game, we're adding more stuff to it. We're not going to the shelf and saying, gee, what do we have in stock? What do we have 500 of? Put that on your next game. That's not a game. I want every single game to be different than the one before. When you go out there and look at Wizard of Oz, you say, hopefully, wow. When you go out there and look at Hobbit, you say, wow. Those two games are not like writing a hit song and having a number one song, and then the band comes out with another song that sounds just like the first song. We don't want easy. I want easier. That would be nice, not to get daily, you know, atomic bombs lobbed at you and things that you have to overcome and things that are your own doing and things that are other people doing. But listen, it goes with the territory. This is only my 40th year in the industry, okay? So I've done a lot of it before. I'm learning about it every day. You surround yourself with really great people so that I could be happy to be the dumbest guy in the room, and that's when I'm the happiest. Right? Anyone? Yes.
So,
what's your name?
Nate.
Nate, how are you?
Good. I have two questions, but first relates to code. So, Kiefer put a ton of work into the operating system.
Right.
What would you say the effort for the second game from the software standpoint is compared to the first?
Well, it's a really good question to ask Keith, you know, and, you know, Keith would be better to answer it, but from what I see, right? What?
More than me.
No. From what I see, it's an amazing amount of work. It's an amazing amount of work.
Like you do to me.
Because on that game, remember, Keith started just Keith.
Yeah.
There was no Ted Estes, right? So Keith is a really proud guy. He's a great pinball player. He's very passionate, and he loves what he's doing. He loves it with all his heart. And he'll, you know, in the beginning, they adopted a baby girl, and Keith's life kind of changed. And he had to devote time to that part of the family, and he had to devote time to the company. And during the day, he was Mr. Mom, right, with Christine, which was great. And at night, he's up all night coding. And, you know, there was a point there where I really felt bad in a way because of everything he was doing. And, you know, to create everything from nothing was monumental. There was no way I know what that is. You know, if I give you my famous thing I say about this, if I give you a bucket of paint and I tell you to paint this room and I leave and come back, I know how much work you did. I have no clue what he does. I have no clue. All right, he's been in meetings where he's been like this. What happened? What happens to him? He's out. And then he's back up, and he's like that again. It's like one of these animated pictures. This is what he does. He is the best. I love Lyman's a good friend, but, you know, all respect to Lyman, I wouldn't trade 12 Lyman's for one Keith. Okay? I love Lyman, but no disrespect there, right? Keith is just a tank. He just keeps going and going and going. And the monumental effort involved, I knew I needed somebody else for him. And, you know, Ted is great, really amazing guy, a very opinionated guy. You know, if you told him, how do you like my shirt, he's not just going to say it's okay. He says, yeah, I don't have a flower on that. I don't like that thing. You know, you're always going to get an opinion from Ted. Ted's not going to say, you know, well, it's okay. You know, you're going to get a lot from him. When I asked Keith about bringing Ted in, Keith says, well, I hang out with him on the QR chat room, and he's a good guy, and he's very capable, but I don't need him. I don't need him. You know, like, I got this. You know, I know you got it. It's nothing about you, okay? It's about the company. We need another great programmer. We need another great designer. We need another great engineer. We need another great... you're building a team. You know, it's not a team of one. So bringing Keith in was amazing in the beginning. It was a dream come true. Bringing Ted on board, how they complement each other and how they work on things. Now where the code is in Hobbit, it's pretty far along. This game's probably about 70% out there. Butch got a code update yesterday that went into it. We got a code update last week. When that game ships, that code is I don't want to say done, because there'll be another update to Wizard of Oz, believe it or not. So that game is a game. It's not a box of lights that's going out, and you're going to shoot the ball around and have inserts that don't do anything. You can see what it is now. So when it goes out in a few weeks to people's homes, it's even more complete. Ted's going to get out of that. Ted's going to get into Pat Lawler's game full-time in the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks, that time frame. Keith's going to finish up Hobbit. When Keith's done with Hobbit, he's jumping into Pat's game. And then they'll do the same. And we'll hire another. We're in the process of hiring another junior programmer right now. So, you know, that's what's happening with that. All right? You got your answer?
Sure. Second question.
I just got this one. Take a break.
You referenced it.
I get a lot more done if I would shut up.
The update to Wizard of Oz.
Okay, so the update to Wizard of Oz, again, Keith's better to answer that, but the part I'll address in the update of Wizard of Oz, you'll be able to do the QR stuff in Wizard of Oz. You'll have a Pendemption option, which some of you heard me talk about, operators especially. So Pendemption will come in three flavors, and you actually will get a different dongle to go in the game, because our games, you will be able at some point in the future to download code and things like that. So we want to know what kind of game you have. So the dongle dictates on the download what kind of game it is. Right now it dictates if it's a regular game, if it's an LE or a 75th anniversary game. So in Pendemption, just to go through it quickly, Pendemption is collapsed rules, and it's easily achievable objectives to get you tickets on a game. Okay, so you can do it with swipe card. At home, if you're a home owner of the game, you could do time play. You could do ticket as you score. And again, collapse rules, easily achievable objectives. The third flavor is to have a physical, mechanical ticket dispenser that mounts on the game, so that in an arcade, you know, you'd be able to do that. So that's what that update will be. And that's probably, you know, a few weeks away, I would say.
And the same thing with the Twitter and all that. I foresee that when we add something in software, a new feature to the platform, we could easily be upgrading Wizard of Oz software to add those capabilities for years to come.
Yeah. I mean, we're probably not going to ever say Wizard of Oz is done. There could be something there. I'm never going to say to the guys, you know, don't ever go back and update that or do something with that. No, we're going to leave it just open. So
I found some errors in the manual I'd like to fix, so we're going to put that
no.
in.
Yes.
Two questions. Does the Hobbit that's out there have a plate field protector on it?
No.
And it doesn't?
No.
Okay. And what is your experience with those protectors? Are they?
So the playfield protectors, we had a Hobbit at earlier shows with the playfield protector on it. And actually, that Hobbit had more frequent flyer miles on it than me. And with the amount of play they get, I was really amazed at the condition of the playfield protector. It had thousands and thousands of plays on it. If you wax it and take care of it, it's pretty good. You could lift it off and just replace it. On the Hobbit, it's obviously a lot easier to replace the playfield protector than on Wizard of Oz, where you have to take off, you know, play with up the playfields and stuff. You know, anything is easier than Wizard of Oz. So you know, it's easier. We sold a lot of playfield protectors for Hobbit on games that will go out. Operators, it was created in my mind for operators especially, because you can put that on there and a year later just take it off and you have basically a brand new game. And we did the same thing with the side artwork where it's the really thick rad cowl that we called it. So if somebody wanted this, they wanted the same look of our direct print cabinets that we did on the LE Wizard of Oz games. We have something now that could be applied to the cabinet at the factory or aftermarket where it gives that durable, beautiful, shiny surface, and it could be replaced if it was damaged. And that was the downside of the direct print cabinets. If they got damaged, they're damaged, you know, and that was...
And unlike the decal that you normally replace, if you got a gouge in the side of your cabinet,
yeah,
and you put a new decal over it, the decal takes the shape of the gouge. This has its, it's so thick that it keeps its own shape. It covers in the holes and the gouges and everything. And it's easy to apply and reposition and all that stuff.
You know, you try to, I don't want to try to take stuff off a game that I would have put on a game anyway. You know, these are things that they may not apply for everybody. So why would we either put them in the game and charge you for it, but still give you an option, just like when you order a car, you know, you want a certain option in the car, you can have it. But the car you're buying from us is loaded because every model we make, it's all the same playfield. You don't have any less rules, you don't have any less features, you don't have any less toys on the playfield. Everything is the same between the LE, the SE, or the standard game on Hobbit too. So.
I have a comment question. For the Wizard of Oz, do you plan update-wise to continue updates? When do you project the last update?
That's my friend Eric.
He's got a lot of hard questions. I just say I can't understand. I'm sorry.
So we'll have this update probably in the next few weeks, and I think that's going to be it for a while. I really don't know, you know, what else we can make that game do unless we put, you know, motor in the head of it and make it fly around the room or something like that. I don't know what else we can do to that game. It's got pretty much everything. You know, Eric, we didn't put the kitchen sink in there. We put the whole plumbing department in there. So it wasn't just the kitchen sink. So there's a lot of it. And you know you've climbed into it and fixed them. So thank you. All right. Yes.
All right, so you put a lot of love in your vision into the machines, and I want to know how you feel about when people modify your game with their own ideas. How do you feel about that?
So, you know, I respect everybody's opinion, no matter what it is, okay? They're entitled to it. So if you buy one of our games and you want to cut it in half with a chainsaw, you're going to void your warranty. I'll tell you that, okay? You're okay to do that. I don't mind that. It doesn't really... I like when people get creative with things. I don't think that the Wizard of Oz had everything it possibly could have had on it. I see pictures where people went and they bought, you know, Hallmark toys, or they made the eyes light up on the trees, or they have all kinds of other things going on with it. I think it's pretty cool to express yourself and how you want to play the game and how you want to have the game. On your location or in your home. It would be the same as saying, I would never have the attitude that, you know, here it is, it's good enough, we thought of everything. You know, people have a lot of great ideas, and some of them are actually better than our ideas, but we can't do them all. You know, we have to deliver a product at some time. Somebody has to be the one to say, the game is finished, stop, ship the game. Okay, somebody has to say that. Because I didn't say that much in Wizard of Oz. People had ideas, and they just piled them on top of each other, and I said, okay, and I said, okay, and I said, okay. And I turned around, and, you know, an extra year passed, and it wasn't a good thing. Creativity has no limit, and that's why really good engineers and good designers, good programmers, all those people, they want to keep creating, and they want to keep doing, and they want to keep playing with stuff. But somebody somewhere in the business side of the company has to say, you know what, this is really cool and I love it, and let's build a game and let's do it.
And it's cool. It's cool to see what other people do with what you give them.
Yeah.
It's like a smartphone or a personal computer. You want your desktop set up the way you like it. You want an app that did something we didn't think about. Oh, geez, you could use that light for the flash for a flashlight. That's cool.
Yeah.
Why would you want not want?
And we get a lot of pictures from around the world, people that did stuff to the game, which is pretty cool. Yes.
The one thing, I don't know if it already got asked or not, but do we have a expected guesstimate on when Hobbits will be in production?
Yeah, we do. Next question. Well, you know, look, being waterboarded every day, as I have been, you know, you get used to that after a while. So just getting an easy question like that, like a poke in the side, is not, it's a reasonable question. You know, the silly answer is when all the parts arrive, that's when we can build games. As parts are arriving now, we're going to be able to build assemblies, sub-assemblies, we'll be able to put cabinets together, back boxes, all that kind of stuff. We have gotten some parts in that haven't been the best, so they got rejected. It happens. You know, last week in Seattle, I talked about some glass that we got that was delaminated, and I heard from the glass guy. I heard from the printing guy, why did you talk about that? And my answer was, why did you make the glass that way? So, you know, this way I don't have to talk about that. You know, just go make what you're making and do it. We have amazing vendors. We really do. They support us in so many ways. They're very cooperative with changes. And really, I'm very lucky to have all of them. You know, even the ones that give us a little bit more trouble. We don't mean to give them more trouble. Hopefully, in the next game, it gets easier too. But they're really great people. And, you know, they're dedicated to us and to our company, again, because everything they make is specific to us. So they want the business, and they want to be part of the process of making parts for us.
You got to remember, when we get a game out like this one out here, it's one of a kind, basically. All the parts on it were made to the drawings and to our specs, but they were made by hand. They weren't mass-produced. And so when you go from that original one, yeah, this looks great and works and fits in the game, we're good with that, start making a bunch of them, well, then the manufacturer starts using pieces of equipment and programming things and different people and bigger, different processes to make them quicker and make them cheaper and get them to us faster. And working in for the Army, we had some camouflage nets.
You make $5,000 toilet bowls. What are you talking about?
Camouflage nets, and they were supposed to be fireproof. They're not supposed to light on fire with an open flame on them like that. They worked with them for years and years, and they worked great. The company decided, well, we can do the same thing as submersing them in this liquid that makes them fireproof by spraying it on. And they started spraying it on, and the government just bought that at first until somebody stick a match to it, and it lit up. And it's like, you're not putting enough of that on there. But they thought they were doing a good job. They thought they were making them cheaper for us. We thought that they knew what they were doing. But you end up with something that doesn't meet the specs again. So back to the drawing board you go. And we were doing that with our parts for pinball, too.
Yes.
So have you thought about crowdsourcing the code?
No. I thought about it when I first talked about the company, when I was really a bigger idiot than I am now. And I said, you know, we're going to open source the code and everything like that. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. You know, especially on licensed themes.
Yeah.
We really don't want Dorothy cursing and everything like that. So
yeah.
I can't do it. You know, I can't. There are other pinball companies that do that, and there's a way to do that creatively for a lot of people. And they make the one-off games, and they make what they make, and they're happy making that stuff, and that's great. But, you know, probably if you have a real company with a lot of real regulations and a lot of real promises that you make people, you probably can't do that in today's world. I want them to do it, but we're not going to be able to do it. Yes,
Jim. One of the early knocks on Jersey Jack was your games are too expensive.
Right.
Obviously, to build the kind, I mean, when you look at Wizard of Oz, it is built like a tank. There's absolutely no way you could possibly manufacture a game for the price that people originally figured. Is Jersey Jack essentially going to become the high-end pinball manufacturer? And how does that limit your market to operators and growing the industry?
So, everybody heard that question? Okay. So look, there's a lot of components of that to answer, but I'll try to keep it like not that, like this. All right. The first part about operators, you know, as being an operator, you know, my question really is not what does the game cost? My question really is what does the game make? Okay? I designed the pusher for a company that was $50,000 and nobody bought it because it was $50,000 until I forced it onto a location and started making X thousands of dollars a day. All of a sudden, everybody forgot about what it costs, right? So, our game is a full-featured game. When it, is there any operators here that have a Wizard of Oz on location? Okay. So, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Kevin.
Kevin. You have a Wizard of Oz. What kind of money does it... we haven't talked about this, have we? No. Okay. What kind of money does it make on location in relation to other games at the location? What's been your experience?
Iron Lion's Classic Pinball.
Okay, cool. That's what I recognize.
The biggest moneymaker in my shop.
Okay, cool. And he's had a lot of problems with it. He got early games. He got a box of parts. He had a lot of aggravation. The games today don't have that. All right? What do I say about pinball for 40 years? Anybody know my patented saying about
pinball? I know this one.
What is it?
If it ain't broke, it ain't pinball.
Right. So I can promise you, I have a service company that made its money. We paid our mortgage to put our kids through college because things break. Okay? I have customers that say to me, I paid a lot of money for that game and it just broke. Right. If you give me $1 million, I'll promise you that the game will break. Right? It's a pinball machine. Welcome to pinball. Right? God bless you, people like Eric and other people that learn. You know, I get customers in Stumbleshit, Wyoming, where there are no people that fix pinball machines. Okay? And you know what happens? I think there is a place called Stumbleshit. If you Google that, yeah. I think there is a place.
Right? Directions to.
Right.
Let's go there.
So, look, and you know what I tell the people? There was a gentleman yesterday that came up to me, and he lives out here in Colorado, and I was talking to Mr. 68, who's not in the room. Everybody knows Mr. 68. And the guy says, I don't know how to fix a pinball machine. I want to buy you Wizard of Oz, but I don't know anything about it. I said, good. You'll fix it with a checkbook. He says, well, I don't want to pay you $100 an hour fixing a pinball machine. I says, good. Meet Mr. 68. His name is Kim Mitchell. He's here with a pinball club. And all these people in this room, all these wacko people, just like us and you, you're all going to be friends. And they're going to come to your house and have a couple of beers and teach you how to fix pinball and play pinball and learn how to do that. And you, too, can be a pinball mechanic. Okay? And I think the guy was going to buy the game. He talked to you, but you had told him that you had a box of parts and you kind of scared him that he might not buy the game. His name is Steve. All right, so he says, maybe I'll buy it from you direct. And I said, no, go back to Lyons and talk to him. Even though he said to me that there's no knock on you, okay? You know I'm brutally honest, which is why I get the crap beat out of me. He said that you told him the game broke, which I could bet it breaks, and you had a whole box of parts. And he said to me, I was happy he said that to me because I knew you would support your product because you sent him a box of parts. Thank you. So you never know how it works. But really, so the first part of your question that I answered last, or the last part of your question I answered first,
like
is
20 minutes
ago. Operators need to be retaught today how to operate a pinball machine, okay? What happened in the last 10 years is pinball became an irrelevant piece of equipment on a location, okay? And operators, here's how we operate, okay? How much money it makes, how much aggravation I tolerate, how much money it makes, how much aggravation I tolerate. Pinball on location makes no money. So I will only buy a pinball machine for location. If the guy's going to throw me out the door and tell me that the other guy's buying him a pinball machine, I'll break down and buy him a pinball machine. Not me. This is Joe Operator. Me, I'll go operate. I operate my pinball machines now. So if anybody else that owns a pinball company tells you that if you go to a bar and they have crappy pinball machines, you, as a nuclear physicist, should go out and buy a pinball machine and operate it. Why don't you ask that person, if operating pinball machines is so good, why don't you operate your own pinball machines? I operate my own pinball machines. I know what they make. So we need to educate those operators how to fix a pinball machine, how to operate a pinball machine. Once it starts making the money, it's going to be great. And we're going to get into that in this next few months, how to do that. What was the rest of your question?
What was your name again?
His name is Jim.
Okay, gotcha. All right, I'm good with you now.
So look, high-end pinball company, right? Our LE is kind of in the same range as Stern's LE. Our LE is a lot less expensive than John Papaduke's game.
Yeah, but they just raised the price to match you.
A lot less.
Well, but I didn't say that. You said that. That's your perception. You know, I can't tell you what it is. I can only tell you that this is what's in the game, and this is what we need to charge for it. There may come a day when we could figure out a way how to make our game less expensive. But, you know, operators come to me a lot of times and they say, you know, I'd love your game if it was $5,000. Yeah, I'd love to drive a Ferrari if it was $20,000. You know, I'd love to live on the top of a, you know, mountaintop retreat if, you know, the house was, you know, $30,000. But this is not What Austin Powers said, right? I want a solid gold toilet bowl, but it's not in the cards, right? So I don't know what the future will bring. I don't see how we can make a game that's as much fun, that will earn that much money on location, that will be really loved and revered for, you know, $4,000 or $3,000 or $5,000. You need to have a big empty piece of wood under there and not much of an operating system and a little circuit board that big that can't go on the internet. And, you know, our game is, you know, this, it's a monster. The thing is a monster. But it enables us to do a lot of other things that will come into play in game number three.
So is Pindemption part of your outreach to operators to make pinball more relevant?
Pindemption, what that did was that showed operators that a pinball machine could actually be a redemption game and it could make money in a location. Now, if I have a game in a location like a Bass Wheel, right? Everybody know what Bass Wheel is? Been to those arcades that give tickets? God bless all of you that don't go to those places, you know. They don't need all money. So a Bass Wheel is like a big slot machine. So you swipe your card, you pull a handle, and this big wheel spins around, and you have nothing to do. You have no skill. It stops on a number, and that's how many tickets you got. Isn't that fun? Isn't that great? Isn't that a one? I'm serious. I couldn't make that up. I wish you invented the game because Baytech sold a billion of them. It's one of the best earning games on location. How about a crane? You know, where you have a machine like this, and it goes like this, and it drops the prize. Isn't that a lot of fun to play that game, right? So pinball is a game of skill. Pinball is a game where you learn and you play better, right? Because it's a game of skill, it's legal in a lot of jurisdictions that other games are not legal in. Washington State's a very difficult location to get amusement games legalized. And New Jersey is a very difficult state because you have casino gambling and things like that. You have a lot of criminals in New Jersey, so they want to make sure everything is really right. So in those states, they want games of skill. Every game, it might have an element of chance because the ball rolls a different way, but the predominance of skill makes it a game that's not a gambling device, okay? And pinball, we know, is not a gambling device. Roger Sharp proved that years ago. You know, we know every pinball story that's ever written has LaGuardia standing there like this with the hammer smashing up the machines. You know, we're in the 21st century now. So we have a game of skill that could translate to an amusement arcade. And our game actually, it teaches you how to play the pinball machine when you play our game. It has this beautiful LCD monitor. So it's kind of a tutorial on the monitor showing you how to start player two, how to start player three, how to start player four, how to start the game, how to shoot the ball, how to flip the flippers. We can do that because you have this wonderful computer in there. And you can do a lot of that stuff. And the game, so let me just say this. The two games we've been operating on location with Pindemption since January, as pinball machines, they were doing between $150 and $300 a week, depending what kind of week it was. They've gone from that to do between $300 and $800 a week, depending on what's going on in the location. So it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different. Bye, Joanne.
God bless you, Joanne. You lasted a lot longer than we thought.
You know, my wife can hear me anytime, and she didn't want me to
embarrass her. And she doesn't want to hear you anytime. That's the problem.
God bless her. Listen, you know, I got to tell you one other thing. You know, Martin records this stuff, right? I can't go back and listen to anything I ever said. I just, my voice, my Brooklyn accent, the whole thing. I had to think of it one time and say it. I can't listen to it again. So anybody listening right now, and wherever that right now is, God bless you for listening to it, because I can't take it. I can't take it. Yes.
So where does Jersey Jack see Jersey Jack Pinball in 5 years? In comparison to the market and what your vision is?
Well, in 5 years, you know, I see a lot more pinball machines commercially on location. I see, you know, probably a couple other companies building pinball machines too, and I don't really see anybody prepaying for a pinball machine for 5 years.
No matter for 5 minutes, I think.
5 weeks. You know, it's hard. It's hard to predict. You know, we look 10 years out, 5 years out, 20 years out. At pinballsales.com, right? Which, if not for pinballsales.com, I wouldn't have Jersey Jack Pinball, right? Because in 1999, I kind of believed that there was a market for home pinball machines, right? To sell games to the home all the time. Operators would sell them around Christmas time. They get rid of their clunkers, and they do one service call. And by Valentine's Day, the game was on the front lawn because it didn't work, and the lady didn't want it in the house anymore, right? So in 99, when I started bringing in hundreds of pinball machines from Europe, and we started pinballsales.com, then in 2000, when I became a Stern pinball distributor, you know, Gary Stern, who's a friend, I still count him as a friend of mine. If he rang my doorbell, I would let him in the building, certainly. You know, he told me in his visionary way, nobody at home ever wants a pinball machine. The internet crap will never amount to anything, and you'll be out of business in a few months. So with that amazing amount of encouragement, I forced him to make me a distributor for Stern Pinball. And, you know, I was the third distributor geographically in New Jersey, and he figured, you know, what's this little guy going to do in New Jersey, you know? Well, you know, Peter Betty from Betson was knocking down Gary's door because we were out selling them 2 or 3 to 1, and they had, you know, stores all over the country and everything like that. We focused on it. We focused on promoting their product. I believed in their product. You know, supported, I still believe in their product. I supported the product. I mean, you know, I can't say anything bad about it because it's a product that is the same product I'm making. So if you have somebody say, oh, that pizzeria stinks, well, why would I eat in your pizzeria? You know, I want to have live and let live. I want more people to build stuff. I want to encourage more people. You know, you all saw Bill Brandy's try to get involved with J-pop stuff, right? So 3 weeks ago, Bill called me as a customer. I said, Bill, you know, if you need help, I can't tell you what to do. You have to figure out what to do. If you need help, I'll help you, you know? And he went down the road to try to see if he could do something like that. I think more people getting involved, trying to build more pinball and get more pinball on location is a good thing. And the last thing I would say with pinballsales.com, when we sold those games to the home back 15 years ago, I believed, I actually said it in print, that the kids that grew up playing those games in all those basements all over the place, they're going to grow up and they're going to go out and look for pinball machines in the wild. And those kids that were 10 years old then are 25 years old now. And those are the kids that are playing pinball, promoting pinball, too. So I think it's grassroots. Yeah. You know, we used to go to these shows, right, and they were all us freaks and geeks.
I just passed a line of 20 kids walking out there.
Now they got all the kids, the wives, the girlfriends. It's going more mainstream, you know. So it's really cool. You got guys like Ed Robertson for Bare Naked Ladies titling an album Silverball and writing songs about pinball. And you got other people, Ryan Adams. Anybody know Ryan Adams? Another guy that really loves pinball. You know, you got Mark Tremonti from Creed and Alter Bridge and his own group loving pinball. You got Slash that still loves it. You got other celebrities and personalities that have pinball. They're going to come forward and push it. So I think what also happened, and the last thing I'll say about this part, is when Stern was the only company, because when you walked up to Gary and people said to him, you know, you have the last pinball company. No, I don't have the last. You know, we're the only one right now doing it because it's really hard and it's difficult to make pinball, which everybody knows it is. When you were the last one doing it, the problem was that you were the last one doing it. And it really didn't get a lot of publicity. But when somebody else came in to do it, and there were two rocks banging against each other, and sparks came from that, people said, wow, what's that noise? What's going on? Maybe there's a reason why another company came in and made pinball. And then when Spooky started doing that thing, or even J-Pop, for as bad as that is for pinball, it got publicity. Some of it not good. You know, but you know, it is what it is, and we gotta be the people that really promote it and push it.
So you want to do something to that end. Look at all the new shows popping up around the country. Go out and tell these people that ran this show, thank you. You guys did a great job. This is a really cool venue. We love what you're doing. These guys have little kids. They're doing this stuff just because they love pinball, and there are people popping up all over the country starting these shows. Support them. Go out there. That's where pinball's going in 5 years.
Right.
It's a cool thing, and it makes me feel cooler being involved with it, and I thank Jack for that.
I think we're just at the beginning of it, actually. I don't think it's up here or going down. I think it's actually right here because, you know, the economy, we sell everything nobody needs. That's pinballsales.com. Right. We sell everything nobody needs. None of you need a pinball machine to live. Well, maybe a few of you need a pinball machine to live.
I need a bunch of them.
Maybe there's a few of you that need it to live. Most people on planet Earth don't need a pinball machine to live. Okay, not a heart lung machine, thank God. But, you know, what do? We want these things, right? So they're really cool. So people that want stuff also, like, nobody's really buying a pinball machine, believe it or not, because of the price. And you could talk to Kevin, okay? You know, they're buying it because they want it. I mean, when we sold, I looked back in some files a few months ago. So in 1999, we sold people Adams families for $1,200. Okay? Now think of this. I bought Adams families for $400 in 1999, not $4,000. You know that. You're doing this a long time. $400. We put like $200 or $300 into the game when we got it. We have an amazing guy, Larry, who at the time was doing stenciling on the side. He'd mask out the whole side of the game, and he'd stencil it out and respray it black and make. Well, now you got decals. Well, we didn't have no decals then. That didn't exist. And we'd sell those games, and guess what? I would sell them for like $1,800. And I was like, you know, gee, I had a game that cost $400. We put $300 into it, and I sold it for $1,800. Who's better than me? Okay?
No cartwheels.
Those people have those games now sitting in their basement. I don't know, probably the Adams family I sold somebody in 2000 for that much money. Sight unseen, even if I was the guy from Antique Roadshow, I'd have to say the game's worth $5,000 without even a look, even with leaky batteries all over his boards. In best case, even $6,000. If I get that back and spit shine it, I can turn around for $7,500 or maybe $8,000 on a good day, maybe even more. So guess what? All your C titles, all your D titles became C titles. Popeye, I had enough Popeyes to line up this whole room. I thought I'd never sell it. I thought I'd never sell a piece of crap. Okay, oh, I'm sorry. You know, it's a wonderful game. I'm into Popeye because I'm an older person. I love the theme and everything like that, but I can't even see where the ball is. Well, guess what? I don't have any Popeyes for sale. They're all gone. Every lid found every garbage pail. Okay? There is a lid for every garbage pail.
You're not going there.
Just like there is a man and a woman for everybody, or a man and a man, or a woman and a woman. I'm not going to get into all of that. There's somebody for somebody out there somewhere. Okay? And these pinball machines, they find their place. And your D title became a C title. Your C title became a B title. Your B title became an A title. When you bought a Fishtails, which was a great, great game, and you bought it for $1,500, all those things in your basements, they're aging like wine, okay? Guess what? Sell two games and buy a Hobbit, okay, you cheap bastard? That's the answer. That's the answer. Not can you make a cheaper pinball machine. There's already cheaper pinball machines out there. Go buy one of those. You want to buy a good game? Sell two of your piece of junk and go buy that. Take your Fishtails and your white water. And get the $9,000 for the two games, $8,000, then go buy a Hobbit. That's the answer, okay? Now you got your answer.
Okay. Playing the part of Jan Guarnieri now. Just calm down, Dad. We're going to get around.
You know I'm buying Pat's game.
Listen, it's good. I'm happy to hear that. This guy, what's your name?
I'm Tim.
We have a five-question limit. No, I'm sorry.
Did anybody see the podcast we did last week from Seattle? How about that guy from Chile? Was that guy amazing?
I turned it off. David Thiel part was amazing.
Well, we don't have David Thiel here today, so you don't have to deal with us.
Yeah, this is what you get. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, so
you know, I'm really thirsty, right?
I'm trying to get
I
more
think that means I'm talking too long.
I'm trying to get more specific. So do you see yourself building one game every 3 years or three games a year?
No, I don't see you.
No.
Well, you know, look, so let's talk about the next year in there, okay?
Killing my battery. Look at this.
We'll be building Wizard of Oz probably through now to 2017, I would imagine, because we have the license to land, we have demand for them. I said last week, I say it all the time, the truth, I've never had a Wizard of Oz pinball machine in a box sitting in the building and say, I wonder who I can sell that to. I never had it. It would be nice to have games. Because I have operators right now that are emailing me and texting me over the weekend. Hey, you told me I had my game for July 4th down the shore. You know, where's my game? You know, I got operators looking for them. I got everybody looking for them. We're still running about a month behind back order situation. My business friends tell me, Jack, that's a great problem to have. But it's a problem. So we have to overcome that problem. So we'll be building Wizard of Oz for a while. As we get into Hobbit, our line can build Hobbit and Wizard of Oz at the same time. It's a little different technology, a little different construction of what we do. Other people, we have a big enough building. We could set up another line to build. You know, if somebody actually came to us and said, "Hi, I have this game and it's ready to be built. Would you build this for me?" You know, I'm not going to say no. I'm going to say yes, because I want to build more pinball machines. So even somebody else's game, we would consider building. And we've talked to certain people about that already, so we'll see what happens, if they're viable to do that or not. So,
So two, three?
Two games a year. You know what? The market can't take a lot of games, honestly. You know, if I was a distributor and I had a lot of things thrown at me, when I was a distributor and I had really one primary pinball machine to sell, I could stock, you know, maybe 100 of those primary pinball machines and sell it. So when you wanted Sopranos from me, I had Sopranos when nobody else in the country or the world had Sopranos. Maybe Mike from Automated had it. You know, and I didn't say, well, I have all the gold and now the price is going up. I was kind of at the same price, and I sold all of those things. If I have, you know, anybody go to In-N-Out Burger at all? My favorite place on earth to eat a hamburger?
Just with you.
They only sell hamburgers. They don't sell hot dogs, they don't sell chicken, they don't sell pizza, they don't sell anything. They just do that one thing and they chug along and they make money. And they're an efficient machine, right? I think making so many models of something and doing that, it really confuses the marketplace in a way. It confuses the customer and it overtaxes the distributor. Because now the distributor is a guy that, as a distributor, I don't know what to buy. So I have to take a pre-order. Okay, you want an LE, you want this one, you want that one, and I sell those. But then I don't know if somebody wants this model, I don't know if somebody wants that color trim. I'm running a shoe store. I have to wait for like a size 5 high heel pump, you know, to walk in the door, and I finally sold that pair of shoes. It's not a good situation financially for a distributor or space-wise for a distributor. So the market really can't absorb so much product, I don't think.
Put up too many games?
Yeah,
these price tags, you're competing with yourself in a year, you know?
And you know what? Look, you talked about price, which is something really valid, right? So look at The Hobbit, okay? Look what that game is physically. And look, I have to be biased because I'm not going to tell you I'm selling Pepsi. I'm not going to tell you Coke is great. But look at The Hobbit, and then go take a look at an MMRLE. You know, go take a look at that game. Now, I sold a bunch of them, you know, as pinballsales.com, but that's $8,000, that game. You know, so the people building it, the belief is, well, you know, I get these people a $16,000 game for $8,000. You know, that's great. You know.
Who's better than me?
But it's still an $8,000 game. So in the marketplace, you have to take your money as Joe customer and say, what's my perceived value? Is it worth it for me to spend $8,000 and buy a Wizard of Oz, a regular game, or a Hobbit regular game, okay, or buy a Medieval Madness? You know, I don't have a Medieval, so I actually bought one for me too, because every time I had a Medieval, it got sold. So I bought one of those. I think it's a great game. You know, I sold a whole bunch of them, and the people that bought them, my job is to say, what do you want to buy? Good, I'll sell you that. That's my job, right? I'm not here to tell you, make a judgment call or whatever. I'm just telling you that when you take that $8,000 and you look at it and you say, hi, $8,000, what do I want to buy? That's the decision that everybody makes. Their perceived value of what something's worth. All right, everybody good? Thank you all. I appreciate all your patience. Thanks for dealing with me and my opinions.
Thank you for signing for us over here in the corner. We appreciate
that. Thank you very much, Eric. Mm-hmm. Everybody. Have fun. I'll catch up with you guys soon. Thank you.